ACEC is excited to announce that registration is now open for its fall conference taking place in Marco Island, Florida, this October. That's right, after a year of Zoom and virtual meetings, we're excited to be bringing our fall conference back as an in-person event. And we can't tell you how excited we are to look forward to seeing you there in person for all of the content, networking, and education that the fall conference is known for. Log on to www.acec.org for more information. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies. Today, ACEC Vice President of Private Market Resources, Aaron McLaughlin, has joined the program for a conversation with Kermit Baker, the Chief Economist for the American Institute of Architects. Kermit analyzes business and construction trends for the U.S. economy and examines their impact on the design industry. Each month, his team publishes the influential AIA Architecture Billings Index, which is a leading economic indicator of construction activity in the U.S. and reflects a 9 to 12 month lead time between architecture billings and construction spending nationally, regionally, and by project type. Until recently, Kermit was a senior research fellow at the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University and project director of the Remodeling Futures Program. So Aaron, I'll turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Kermit, for joining us today. We're very excited, hopefully, to talk about our rebound out of the pandemic-caused recession and learn more about AIA's economic offerings. As you all know, many AIA members are also members of ACEC firms, and so there is a lot of crossover between what you all do and what we do in tracking the economy. So, you know, with that, I thought we could get started perhaps with you guys, you giving us an overview of the Billings Index and also the most recent release, which came out last week.
Exactly. And let me start, Aaron, by just giving our readers a little background on, or our listeners a little background in terms of what our Architecture Billings Index is. We've been running this for over 25 years now. It's a monthly survey of U.S. architecture firms. We have about 750 architecture firms that participate in this every month. That's 750 out of 18 or 19,000 architecture firms nationally. So they're selected because they represent that larger number of firms in terms of their size, in terms of their location geographically, and in terms of the specialization, the markets that they serve. We get, because all firms that are involved in this have volunteered to participate, we get a very, very high response rate. And so we get a pretty stable tracking of what's going on in terms of design activity from month to month. So we, like virtually everything else in the economy, design activity tanked as the pandemic hit in 2020. And it was really in March, April, May, the weakest numbers we have seen in the 25 years that we've been running this index.
The numbers last year.
The numbers last year were the weakest we've seen. Began to stabilize a little bit towards the end of this year. And then in February of 2021, we saw a positive number by our nomenclature. That's a score over 50. And we've now seen six straight months of positive numbers in terms of Billings Index.
Right.
So a good strong run now in terms of what we're seeing as a clearly design recovery.
So how much have you guys seen any significant regional differences? I know from some analysis that we've done, you know, the residential market is having, you know, quite a moment over the last year, and that's in very much concentrated in sort of the Sun Belt area of the U.S., you know, and we're keeping an eye on that because of sort of community infrastructure that will develop as a result of new housing in those states and metropolitan regions. I was wondering if you could speak to any regional or geographic trends that you've seen from the index?
Yeah, no, great point, great question. And curiously, we're seeing the strongest numbers come out of the Midwest now.
Oh, wow, okay.
Some of the weaker numbers coming out of the Northeast. So it's not exactly tracking what you're seeing, and I think what everyone else is seeing in terms of the residential market, where there's some movement to warmer climates, but quite frankly, movement to affordable areas too.
Right.
And the Midwest does meet that definition. Most of the markets in the Midwest are affordable. But yeah, we'll see how this tracks out. But right now, the strongest region is the Midwest. The South has been historically strong during the downturn. It didn't fall as much, but right now, as I said, the strongest numbers are coming out of the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. And are you seeing any trends or particular strengths within certain market sectors, such as, you know, commercial versus education and so forth?
So we track three major sectors. One is multifamily residential, the second mm-hmm. commercial, industrial, the third is institutional, and a little bit of detail below that. So the first sector to recover, firms that were specializing in the multifamily residential sector, were seeing strong numbers as of mid-year 2020. So they recovered really quite quickly. And that was reflecting, I think, what you had said before, the single family residential market really didn't skip much of a beat during this at all. It came on very strong. The weakest initially was on the commercial side, not a surprise. Retail, offices, lodging, those are kind of the service sectors of the economy that saw the steepest downturn. On the institutional side, some pretty healthy numbers coming out of healthcare, and again, probably not much of a surprise, and some weak numbers coming out of the educational market. That's critical because education is the strongest building sector in our economy. It's the largest building sector in our economy.
Right.
But as we saw more and more movement to distance education and things like that, remote learning, there just wasn't a lot of need to add new facilities. So, you know, we think that'll catch up as more and more kids go back to school and as colleges and universities continue to reopen. But initially, it was very weak. Now, those are broad sectors. Kind of within that, there were a few segments that were doing extremely well, warehousing being one, which is, sometimes included in the retail sector, sometimes included in the manufacturing sector, depending on how it's used. Data centers did very well, for example. So some of the, you know, what I would call new economy sectors of construction continued to perform quite well. But those related to, you know, anything related to travel or hospitality, amusement and recreation, anything where kind of there might be, more people involved.
Right.
Or
less chance for social distancing.
Exactly.
Yes.
Those are the ones that really got hammered during the initial months.
Right. Yeah. We're seeing the exact same thing. And for the education market is second when you consider all sort of vertical and horizontal markets to transportation in the U.S. So we're also ramping up our analysis of that market for our member firms.
Great.
So we want to move on and talk to you a little bit about the AIA Consensus Construction Forecast Panel, which mm-hmm. is the other, you know, economic analysis that you all do and release. I believe it's twice per year. And we were hoping you could sort of share with us some of your recent results from sort of giving an analysis of that, and so maybe sort of explain for our listeners, you know, the kind of panel that you can convene or what kind of data you look at regarding that.
Yeah, so our Consensus Construction Forecast Panel is a very different exercise than our Architecture Billings Index. As you mentioned, Aaron, we do it twice a year. We release a kind of an initial look in January of the year, and that's for that year and the following year. So in January of 2021, we would have had forecasts for 2021 and 2022. And then we do a mid-year update that we release in July, and that would be for the remainder, the one mm-hmm. we just released for the remainder of 2021 and again, 2022. The input for that are, you know, 8 or 10 of the major construction forecasting firms in the country. And we asked them to supply sort of top line information for the major sectors in terms of growth or decline in construction spending. And then we aggregate those up into what we call a consensus, really just an average of all the all the forecasts we get from the participants. So when we did this in January 2021, was looking fairly weak, a kind of a 5 or 6% decline in spending for 2021, and then a mild recovery in 2022. When we did the mid-year update, it was a little more encouraging, smaller decline in 2021 and a stronger recovery in 2022. But for both of those, the decline and the recovery were, you know, kind of low to mid single digits. So we weren't seeing massive swings either way. And I think 2022 is going to be a transition year. You know, we'll see some parts of the construction industry begin to recover, I think, in later this year, 2021. But we'll be, to see all sectors recover, we'll be well into 2022. And so that's why we're seeing kind of modest numbers on average overall. And I think that's going to lead to a stronger recovery in 2023 and 2024, quite frankly, as we see sort of all of the issues we're dealing with now begin to be resolved.
Right. And so I wanted to chat about some of those issues or challenges that you all called out in the mid-year report. So a couple of them, which are connected, are, you know, inflation and supply chain disruptions. I was wondering if you could sort of speak to how that's impacting the architecture community and their work with their clients.
Yeah, architecture firms, we just asked them this question recently, how big of an issue is this from projects you're working on? And we gave them a whole list of potential issues, and, you know, inflation, and I think it's very much tied to supply chain, is number one on their list in terms of, and for obvious reasons. I mean, we're seeing a doubling of the prices of some core construction commodities like lumber and plywood, steel, copper and brass, and things like that, and oil that we don't, you know, energy we don't measure directly, but it sort of feeds into so many things like plastics and asphalt and other sorts of things. So we're seeing this huge surge in the price of key construction commodities, number one. And when you see price surges, it's almost usually related to availability issues. Same sort of thing. You know, lumber prices are expensive, but I can't even get it at any price, or I can only get it, you know, on 4, 5, 6 month back order or something like that. So it really is, you know, it really is grinding back on the growth we would have seen in construction activity. I think it's causing owners and developers to rethink some projects. It's causing contractors to, you know, to build in escalation clauses on some of the bids they submit. There's just, you know, an awful lot of risk associated with it, because, you know, commodity prices are very, very difficult to forecast. And I think they're particularly difficult now because the source of those problems are widespread. And I think they relate back to the second issue, which is supply chain, that, you know, in our global economy, we're just, you know, companies are just sourcing from numerous sources around the locations around the globe. And just one modest hiccup in one of the many inputs they may have to production can slow the whole process down. And that's what we're seeing.
In your analysis, have you noted that the residential boom is directly tied to sort of lumber and some of the other material issues that we're having? And I'm wondering, you know, it's not necessarily directly related to a lot of the work our member firms do, but if you could sort of talk a little bit about what you've done at Harvard over the years, and how housing affordability and urban planning and sort of how that is factoring into what we saw during the pandemic and what we're seeing now with regards to housing and some other issues.
Yeah, a very complicated set of issues that you're touching on there in terms of, you know, it costs more to build a new home. And that sort of indirectly is driving up the price of existing homes. And so we're now seeing, you know, house prices increase at a, you know, 10, 12, 15% annual rate, which is clearly unsustainable, but in the short run, it creates a lot of problems. I think number one on that list is affordability. And I think that's kind of related to a topic we were talking about before, where we're seeing the activity, where are we seeing the strong demand for housing? It's not in San Francisco and Los Angeles and Seattle and Portland and Boston and New York and DC, because those are the high price markets across the country. And so households, when they have more flexibility to choose a place to live because they may be working remotely, are going to gravitate to, you know, places near family, places that are a little more interesting kind of geographically or topographically, or most fundamentally places that are more affordable. I can get a lot more house in this market than the one I live in now. And I need that space because my wife and I are both working remotely. Our kids are you know, going to school remotely. You know, we just need more quiet space. We need more room to spread out. And, you know, I can't afford that in the place I was living. So I look to other places where maybe I do have more space.
Right. It will be so interesting to see how the pandemic and how our remote ability to work remotely and learn remotely will change the built environment, I think, in the years ahead. And, you know, some of these markets that we've discussed today that are strong, you know, data centers, industrial logistics, residential sort of feed into, you know, that global experience that we've all had and sort of returning to home and maybe looking for different kinds of houses in different locations. I know AIA has a lot of firms that do residential design. At ACEC, we have a lot of firms that do land development design, you know, that design the new residential and mixed use developments that we're seeing sort of grow and maybe even be hampered in their growth by some of these constraints.
One small point, just talking to someone about home design, and for the last 15 or 20 years, we've been gravitating towards, you know, an open space layout, kind of, you know, multi-function rooms, you know, space that can be used, you know, sometimes of the day for this and other times of the day for that. And now I think we're going back to kind of 20, 30, 40 years ago when there were very compartmentalized uses, you know, very distinct you know, barriers between rooms. But when you need quiet for a home office, you don't want it to be next to the kids' playground or the exercise room or the media room or whatever else.
Yeah. So turning back to commercial buildings, I noted in the mid-year report that we were discussing that you all called out the retrofitting of existing buildings and how, you know, that has really been an increasing market for AIA members. That's certainly been an increasing market for ACEC members too. And I think we're seeing a lot of that as states and localities sort of dictate, you know, trying to get to net zero or carbon neutral goals, you know, by 2030 or 2050. And I was wondering if you could speak to, you know, how that that call for a more sustainable environment is impacting the market and the outlook for AIA members.
Sure. And I think there's several factors at play here. One is, well, let me just give you a few of the top line statistics. We have been asking architecture firms for the last two decades or so, what share of their project work on a revenue basis consists of work on existing buildings? And back in the run-up prior to the Great Recession, the boom, the construction boom we were having there, about a third of buildings at architecture firms were work on existing facilities. Those might be additions, those might be renovations, they might be historic preservation. That share has been steadily growing. And the last census we did for 2019 showed that buildings on for work on existing billings was just a hair under 50%. So it's grown, you know, almost 15 percentage points between, you know, prior to the Great Recession and the most recent numbers. You know, I think the pandemic-induced recession that we've just been through heightened those numbers even more. In fact, we mm-hmm. asked architecture firms, and now we're seeing that well over 50% of work is on existing facilities. Now, you mentioned one reason for that, and I think that's an important one, sort of sustainability and trying yes. to make our buildings more efficient. A lot of these buildings that were built in the, you know, 50s and 60s when energy was cheap and there was just kind of no real incentive to make them energy efficient. And that's very different now. But I think we're also seeing the U.S. you know, economy and the U.S. population grow much more slowly, particularly, you know, up here in the Northeast and the Midwest, that we just don't have a lot of growth, and therefore we don't need a lot of new buildings. And what we need more is making older buildings more efficient. I think that's what we're seeing. And a third factor kind of related to that is the design of a lot of buildings, particularly in the commercial sector, but I think it's true for schools and healthcare also. You know, how we use that space pre-pandemic is very different than how we're using that space and how we're going to be using that space.
Absolutely.
Post-pandemic. You talked about social distancing concerns and things like that. And you have a lot of facilities that, you know, the old layout just doesn't work in a post-pandemic environment.
Right. Yeah, we're certainly seeing that, especially our members that, you know, subconsult to architects and provide MEP services, you know, how HVAC requirements have changed or how energy efficiency and energy load considerations are changing design. So I think both the architects and the MEP engineers are certainly walking hand in hand, you know, with that market and facing those clients. So
yeah. HVAC is very high on the list of concerns. We talked about use of space and social distancing, but airflow and other sorts of things are just really critical to making buildings healthier. So you're absolutely right. I'm sure your members in those areas are very, very busy.
Right. So lastly, we wanted to talk about the potential infrastructure package. You know, every day we wait to hear what's happening on Capitol Hill and what kind of chances we have for this. And obviously, you know, there's quite a bit. The concept of infrastructure and what infrastructure is has also entered into the lexicon, you know, during these discussions over the last year. And the Biden administration has certainly broadened, I think, even beyond the built environment, what the concept of infrastructure and social infrastructure means. So, so Kermit, we were wondering if you could give us some of your feedback on that and what you're hearing from members and what they would like to see or look forward to seeing out of that kind of legislation, hopefully, that will pass.
Sure. The broad definition, I think, is of very critical interest to our members, because you're talking about, you know, upgrading facilities and other sorts of things that are really in the wheelhouse of most architecture firms. Now, we're seeing this recently sort of split into two pieces, the, you know, what I would call the more traditional infrastructure bill that was passed by the Senate and looks like it has a reasonable chance of passing the House. Right. But, you know, what is it, over $1 trillion all in, but I think about $550 billion of new spending devoted there is mostly, you know, mostly in the traditional infrastructure, you know, sphere, I think. And for that reason, you know, your members maybe some benefits, see some benefits from that. I think architects are likely to not be terribly engaged in a lot of those streets and highway, bridges, water systems, things like that. But they do, you know, the whole purpose of infrastructure is it spurs other activity.
And right.
So you have, you know, new and upgraded infrastructure, you're also going to have new buildings and new homes around those areas as we see, you know, the kind of operations that can move more efficiently in those areas. So I think the spin-off of that, the indirect, will be pretty significant. But it's really this other package that they're going through the traditional budget process that does contain most of what you referred to as social infrastructure that's dealing more with buildings and home and home healthcare support and preschool education support and things like that, that really would have a much more dramatic effect on certainly our architect members, and I think quite fundamentally your engineering members too.
Yeah, well, we want to thank you very much for joining us today. Jerry, did I miss anything?
I think you covered it all.
Okay, great.
Thanks so much, Kermit.
Thank you. Good seeing you guys again.
And this has been the Engineering Influence Podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies. Thanks for listening.